This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. Thank you again for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. My guest today is Bill Rivers, and we're going to talk about his novel, Last Summer Boys. Before we get started, thanks to all of those who've written a review on Apple Podcasts. If you like the podcast, please do write a review. It does help grow the podcast. And I appreciate all those people on Patreon who've supported the podcast. Again, my little book, Digital Contagion, 10 Steps to Protect Yourself from Surveillance Capitalism, is available. You can get a free infographic on my website if you give me your email, which means I collect your data to tell you why you want to not get your data collected. So you can enjoy the irony there. Also, I want to tell you that the ACT Institute is hosting a conference called the Poverty Cure Summit. It's the second one. It'll be on November 2nd. It's a live and hybrid event, and we're going to have a number of panels and discussions about poverty, neighborhoods, thinking about inflation and how inflation affects poverty. It also affects everyone, really. And so that's on November 2nd. I'll have more details coming, but you can look for that at acton.org and search the Poverty Summit. You can register, you can watch online, or if you're in the Grand Rapids area, we'd love to have you come. So my guest today is Bill Rivers. We're talking about his novel, Last Summer Boys. Bill is an author. He's a former Pentagon speechwriter. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Delaware and a master's degree in public administration from University of Pennsylvania. And he also has a day job where he does communications and other things. So it's good to have, it's always inspiring to have somebody who has a day job who's writing so much. It inspires those of us like me who don't write enough to get the work done. So Bill, thank you very much for taking the time to join the Moral Imagination Podcast.
Michael, thank you so much for having me. It's a delight. And just what a fantastic name for a podcast, by the way, The Moral Imagination.
Thank you. Well, I got it from Edmund Burke. So
yes, it just grabbed me right away when I saw it. Oh, that's great. And Edmund Burke, there was a man who had a way with words.
Indeed, indeed. As do you. So we'll talk about your book.
Thank you.
And the other thing, I think maybe we'll say this too, that this is, we were going to talk about in the writing process, but speaking of Edmund Burke, I mean, you wrote part of this book at the Russell Kirk Center.
That's right.
Who's a great modern Burkean. And with you were up there to take some time, a sabbatical, to write this, a lot of your book up there at the Russell Kirk Center. So we're grateful for the Annette Kirk and Jeff Nelson, their work at the Russell Kirk Center, for letting get this really nice book out. So I enjoyed your book very much.
Thank you.
So let's maybe, I want to talk about a little bit of your background and how you start writing a novel and what the inspiration was and maybe some of the themes of the book. But why don't we start with the big idea of the book? Tell me a little bit about the theme, and I recommend that people read it. I like it. And so, but why do you think people should read this book, and what was the inspiration in writing it? Let's start there.
Yeah. Thanks so much. So the simplest way to say it is I wanted to tell a hopeful story about a family that loved itself and wanted to stay together in a time of change and turmoil. Basically, I wanted to tell a hopeful story, and a lot of people felt kind of like hopeless. You know, families are, it's hard to have a family, and people desperately want happy families. And I just wanted to tell a story about that. And there are lots of stories out there, lots of great stories about pain in families and broken families, whether it's the classic tradition or more modern ones. But I just felt that there are so many interesting things you could have within a family. And so this is a story about a family trying to keep itself together, first and foremost. And then secondly, the it takes place in 1968. And so that's a time of great societal change, turmoil, pain, the assassinations of Dr. King, Senator Kennedy, just months apart, bitter domestic politics, foreign war that was extremely divisive, and just America in a moment of confusion. And so the other big theme is just the value and the dignity of every human person. And I wanted just to show that. And everyone's life matters, even people who hate us or disagree with us. And that was part of it. And the main characters are these young boys who have to exist in this turmoil and learn these things, and not just learn them, but also try to act on them. And I wanted to show how people can act on these things and how that changes your reality. So I would say those are the two big ideas.
No, it's very good. So as you said, like, the, you know, I don't want to give all the story away, but it's set in 1968 and it's a nice, you have these three brothers. It is a hopeful story and it's a very positive story, but there's struggle, there's worry. I think one of the things you do quite well is the youngest character, boy, Jack. There's one of my favorite parts of the book is when it's almost very subtle, but he has this experience where he just knows he's loved by his family. And I love the way it just came out. It was very subtle. It was good, but he's anxious. He's anxious about his brother having to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That's his oldest brother. His middle brother is an ardent fan of Senator Kennedy, and his father is not. That's Robert Kennedy. And so there's tension in the family. So it's not as if like, oh, everything's perfect here, you know, but there's tension in the family. And then the character who enters in is, in some ways, he starts out as this awkward, as the cousin Frankie, who's come from the city where his father, like, there's fire, there's burning riots and fires. His father is a policeman. He's been hurt. And Frankie comes in, and in one sense, he looks like kind of going to be this weak character, but he ends up being a very strong character in a subtle way, who becomes this force for courage and insight for the youngest boy, for Jack. And the thing is, I just, for listeners, it's not that there's no tension. It's a happy story. It's a hopeful story, but there's definitely turmoil. There's tension. And I think rooting in 1968, and again, with the assassinations of Senator Kennedy and Martin Luther King, you can feel it. And then you bring in other tension, which we'll talk about it a little bit more in the political aspect, but that they're trying to not just keep their family together. They're trying to keep their land. There's the promise and the threat of economic progress.
Right.
And the threat of crony capitalism and of collusion and power and how you deal with power. And then all these things are there. So I think it's quite a lovely story and gripping. And I'll say, like, I started reading it and I was tired and I knew I had to go to bed because I had to get up and work the next day. But I was like, okay, just one more chapter. I gotta find out what's happening. So, it's quite engaging, you know. It's you know, for the record, it's not an adventure. It's not like a Robert Ludlum or something novel. Mm-hmm. Not that type of excitement. But it is really an engaging book. You did a very good job. So, let's talk a little bit about this character.
Yeah.
Jack. He's the narrator.
Right.
And how old is he?
Jack is probably about 13 years old, 13. He's closer to childhood than he is to adolescence, but he's on the cusp of adolescence.
Right.
And so he is, I think you're right. You know, the primary concern Jack has is his oldest brother, Pete, who he just reveres, is about to turn 18 and presumably be drafted and sent to Vietnam. And Jack very naively, innocently overhears some men in the barbershop grumbling that, you know, famous people, actors and movie stars who are protesting the Vietnam War, they don't get drafted. And he naively thinks, oh, if I can make my older brother famous, he won't get drafted. And that's his myopic and naive mission that he sets out on. But Jack is a fixer. He is an anxious little guy. He knows he's loved. And he sees himself as kind of a supporting person. His job is to support his brothers in their exploits because he reveres them, and he sees his city boy cousin coming in. He thinks, well, how can I enlist him in my battle to help save my brother? And he's a tenderhearted guy, a little bit naive, or even a lot of bit naive, but he learns, and his mission, I think, is, without giving it away, his mission is successful, but not in the way that he expects it. His mission is to keep his family together. And he's first person. It's told from his point of view. And I know we'll talk a little bit about writing, but I hated reading the first person growing up. I never thought, somehow to me, that made the story less formal or less serious of a tale. And the only way I could write this story was first person from his point of view. I actually tried to write it from the city boy cousin's point of view in third person, and it just wasn't working.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, actually, let's just talk about that. Before I think the other thing I liked about Jack is he has also, both ordered and disordered, you know, not, he's young, but the sense of justice too. Like, he wants justice. He also doesn't want things to change. And there's an element where, as you said, he's on the cusp of adolescence, but he's like a child. And so he has power. He's trying to figure out how to use this power. And he does try to use the power for the good. But as you said, often will make errors. And I think there's something sweet about his reverence for his older brothers and his kindness. He's kind to Frankie. His brothers are actually all good, but they're a little bit harsh, like as you bring it on the beginning. You like Jack, you feel for Frankie, and you kind of Pete and Will, you know, they little, especially Will, he needs a little bit of a smack upside the head a bit, you know, and you bring that out, but there's also something good about them. Like they're very kind to him. At one point he gets sick with like tick bites and things and Lyme disease kind of thing. And he's sick. And I remember there's one, like the brothers come and talk to him on the porch and they don't go out and go into their adventures. And he's incredibly grateful for this, but also feels bad. They should be out on their adventures, but that they're paying attention to him. So much is that they're encouraging and challenging to him. And I think that you bring out that tension between the brothers. And I think, as we said, with the second brother, Will is very passionate, right? Mm-hmm. He's passionate about politics. He's a little bit proud and self-absorbed, like maybe any 17-year-old would be.
Sure.
He's in love with a beautiful girl, but also has, I think, a proper sense of shame about that. Like he loves her, but it's like real. Like he wants to be gentle with this. And so I thought that was also a nice thing, because if you think about it, in 1968, you know, sexual revolution is getting underway. You kind of get hints of the sexual revolution. At the same time, there's this more of a traditional sense of like romance and order amongst disorder. So Will is torn between the worlds of kind of the Young Turks, Bobby Kennedy. He's a bit of a liberal, and his father's conservative. And at the same time, Will, you can tell he wants family and values the same things that Jack does. That's what I'm getting. I mean, feel free to say.
No, thanks. I think that's right. So Will is the most dynamic of the three brothers. You know, he's the one who changes the most over time. And he is passionate. You know, he worships Bobby Kennedy. You know, that's his hero, as a lot of young people did. He was kind of the first young political figure post the TV age, I think, in the 60s, that people just could, young people in particular who felt disaffected, could fall in love with and be inspired by. And it's good to have heroes, which the mother tells him at some point. But I wanted to kind of suggest that Will's, it's a little bit misplaced. It's good to have heroes, but you know, no matter how great a political figure is, you know, they're going to let you down at some point, or something can happen. And what softens Will is not, you know, the loss of his hero, but it's you know, falling in love with this beautiful young girl that is. And I wanted to show that in a hopefully a realistic, but also kind of an innocent way, because remember they're also living out in the sticks. And she's a townie. So there's a town dynamic, and then there's a more rural dynamic. And the family out in the woods kind of looks down on the town. There's this development there, this new building, this new townhomes, and they all look just the same, you know, like that old song, you know, little boxes on the hilltop. And they all look just the same, whereas the brothers live in this, you know, 200-year-old stone house that's been there for forever. So they look down on the town, but the townies, some of the other boys in town, you know, regard them as hicks, as kind of barbarians. And to some extent, they're right. These brothers are barbarians. They're savages in the woods, you know, and especially Pete and Will are kind of noble in that way. They fight, you know, they hang out in the woods. So there's a nobility to them. They have this honor code, and they chafe under kind of the norms of the town.
Well, and two, just to interrupt, like young Jack at one point is very upset that his brother Will isn't fighting somebody for honor.
Yeah.
And Will, in his one sense, is like, well, I'm not going to fight until it gets to a point where he has to fight. And then finally, like Jack's like really proud of him, you know, and like, he did it, right? But he was upset in the beginning, like you should have done it faster. And like, he's really hurt that, that Jack is kind of crying, like, is my brother, like, does he not have honor? Does he not care about our family? So Jack's a very interesting character of like, of a certain type of way of seeing the world and tradition. And, you know, I mean, like, I don't know if I talked about this podcast before, but Louis L'Amour is a very interesting writer.
Yes.
Where he's very simple, right? But he's kind of always doing this tension between justice, the city, the savages. How does a man work? How does civilization engage in an honor society? And you can kind of see this tension, I think, in your but among the children, which is very interesting.
You know, it's funny you should say that. My father loves Louis L'Amour. And I mean, we have probably 100 of his paperbacks. And I didn't start reading Louis L'Amour until I was a little bit older, really probably college and then after college. And I read him less because it was really, at first, less because it was something that was interesting to me and more because it was a thing that my dad enjoyed and I liked. You know, I was out of college and living away from home, and I thought, well, I'll read this story. And those stories are very simple. They're kind of formulaic, and there's so much to them. And I actually have recommended them. And I think everything you describe is there. And one of the best of Louis L'Amour stories, I think, is Last of the Breed.
Oh, yeah. About, it's great.
Yeah. And it's just great.
That's first one I read, actually.
Is it really? Okay. That's great.
So my brother-in-law, one of my brothers-in-law, he's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army and was a Black Hawk pilot and a historian and just really interesting. He's a very well-educated man. And he loves Louis L'Amour. And so I said, okay, what Louis L'Amour should I read? He goes, here, read Last of the Breed. So I read Last of the Breed, and then I got another one. I read it. And so one Christmas, he gave me like 5 Louis L'Amour books. And yes. I think I had them all done by January.
Yeah, exactly. They go so fast.
And I just recommended to a good friend of mine. He was like, oh, you have anything to read? I said, yeah, of course, Louis L'Amour. And I think last week I talked to him. I said, how's he going? I said, oh, I've read 2 already this year. You know, and that was like this summer, I told him. And this, you know, he's like, so yeah, they're great, but they're actually the Last of the Breed's the first one I read. And then, but keep going. I need to have a whole podcast on Louis L'Amour.
Oh, no, exactly.
But go ahead. Last of the Breed, you were saying.
Last of the Breed, I think, does very well. You have a American pilot, you know, shot down over the old Soviet Union, and he has to escape during the Cold War, but he's of Native American ancestry, and he draws on his heritage and his tradition and his memories, I think, growing up with his grandfather, who mm-hmm. you know, lived that life very
fully. He's half Native American, okay. Sioux tribe, I think
he's
half Scottish Highlander.
Yes, that's it.
And so he's a very interesting character.
Very interesting character.
And a pilot, he's a technocrat.
And he's a technocrat, right. And he shot down over the Soviet Union, and it opens, I think, with him in this, you know, prison camp. And of course he escapes, and it becomes the Soviet state after this American who was not only, I think, you know, representative of individualism and freedom, but also like the entire Native American tradition is encapsulated in this man and keeps him alive and helps him survive against the harshness of the Siberian winter, against the harshness of the, you know, the communists who are after him. And it also, it gives him the tools to survive and thrive as he encounters different people across, you know, the barren wastes that he helps. And it's just a phenomenal story. And so you got to be careful what you read, because all that kicks around inside your head, and you want to be well-read and you want to read great stuff and have great breadth and depth. I'm sure I didn't consciously try to evoke any of that, but you can't not read a whole bunch of Louis L'Amour and not have it live somewhere inside your heart and your mind.
Exactly.
and hope that it's there.
It's good too. I mean, I think people may be shocked to hear us talking about, like, it's not the classic literature. Okay. But I think it would fall into, I don't know if John Senior puts it in what he would call the good books, but you know, if not, he should have, because Louis L'Amour, they're good books. And like Jubal Sackett, for example.
Yeah.
And Barnabas Sackett series, you really see this. Barnabas Sackett is, you know, he comes from England in early 1600s before Jamestown, has this relationship with Native Americans where he has like some of them are for his friends and some are constantly attacking him. And then his son, the same thing as he goes out into the West and this kind of whole frontier idea. But what's really interesting is this tension between Barnabas, who is in many ways, he's English Christian. Mm-hmm. And now he's in an honor culture. And some of the tribes, one of the chiefs, when he dies, is sad that Barnabas dies, because he's, against who am I going to test my braves to see how they can fight? Because there's this honor relationship there. And then the same thing, and we can move off back into your book, but I think in Louis L'Amour, like in the Kilkenny stories, you have this very interesting tension of like, what happens in a place where there's community, and this actually relates to your book, by the way, mm-hmm. where there's community, but there's people who are in charge are not just, and there's not rule of law. It's like the man who shot Liberty Valance, right? There's rule of law yet. And so you need this character like Kilkenny, who is going to protect the innocent against the powerful, right? So that they think, in like Plato's bad guy, Thrasymachus, that justice is the rule of the stronger. And he has to say, well, okay, if that's the case, then I have to be stronger than you to actually do real justice, to give people their due. And then the tension happens when, in fact, he's also not wanted, because as the society becomes more ordered with rule of law and civilization comes to the Wild West, now the Kilkenny fact, yeah, he's not there anymore. And there's this kind of tension between how do you have justice and progress and all these things in the Louis the More books. And you do that in your book, by the way. I mean, that's one of the tensions in your book, is this community wants to build a dam and they want to take away the property of just like three or four people, including Jack and Will and Pete's family. And now how do they resist that? And maybe we can talk about that in a minute, but let's talk about this first person thing that you brought up. But you said you didn't like reading things in first person. Why is that? And then what changed? Talk about that a little bit.
You know, I couldn't tell you. I just was an odd little kid, I guess, but we'd go to the library and I'd, you know, go through books and, you know, actually just pick out books by their cover, and just cause you're a little kid and don't know any better. But I just felt like it was too informal. And I thought, well, if I'm reading a story, it needs to be something that's important. It, never mind that all these phenomenal stories are first person, you know? And it just felt kind of, I guess felt sloppy to me. But what I wanted to say is that I have been totally humbled in that I spent 2 years of my life, you know, trying to write this story in between jobs and everything else from the point of view of one character, third person. And I got a fair distance in it. And a member of my family read some of it and delivered that awful hammer blow. They said, this is boring. And it's boring. And I tickle on the back of my mind, well, what if you switched it up, the characters, and made it first person? And I thought, well, let me just try it. And I tried it, and I think in 10 pages, I had covered what had previously taken about 50 pages to do. And it was far more interesting. And because it's in the first person, it gives you more opportunity to show the voice of a character. And so I was able to develop Jack's voice by telling it in his voice in the present tense, which is a decision that, again, I thought was kind of odd, but I realize when you're having a conversation with a friend, when you're telling a story and you're really into it and they're really into it, you kind of slip into the present tense. You're like, okay, so I'm sitting here and I look up and the next thing I see, and I thought, okay, let's get this feel and we'll accept this as a feel. It's a little bit of a tall tale. It's a little bit of a little boy in the moment, and he's a reliable narrator, but he's not always the most accurate. So what he's telling you is what he really thinks happened, but it may not always be exactly how it went down. But that's part of the fun, I think, is if you can do that in a certain way, you can read the story and you can see what's actually happening, and you can see it's clear if you're, you know, older and a bit more mature and have some wisdom about the way the world works, that what he sees is not, and how he's reporting it, it's how he really perceives it, but it's clear that something else is happening. And I think you see that a bit with how he observes his older brother falling in love with this girl, the town, you know, beauty. And they have a whole conversation that is not at all about the conversation they're having. It's unspoken things between this 16-year-old boy and this 16-year-old girl as they're standing on opposite sides of the front of the church, not looking at each other, really. And he's observing it, and this little boy, and to him, he's missing the entirety of what is happening here. And really, this girl is wanting this boy to ask her to spend time together, to go out and do whatever. And he is working himself up to do it. And the brother is observing this and not picking up on any of it.
Right.
And it's funny, people love the voice and the atmosphere. I hear from people, they say that's the thing they most love. So basically, if there are writers listening and you're just, you know, smacking up against a brick wall and it's not working out the way you think it should, my encouragement is just try it differently, because it could all fall into place and it could be the thing that people seem to enjoy most. Humility, right? Writers need humility. And if I hadn't wasted 2 years trying to do it third person, you know, who knows?
Yeah, well, it turned out it's really good. So let's actually talk about that. I do want to get to the themes because you have some themes, and I'll just put this forward for listeners. Like, you have some themes that are interesting about community, about justice, about how communities get together, in a sense, to resist encroachments. How Pagan the Fam. So there's, I think, a lot of Tocquevillian themes here. I'm a big fan of Tocqueville. So I want to talk about some of those themes. But let's actually talk just briefly about your writing. So as we were talking beforehand, you said you have a degree from University of Pennsylvania in public administration. It's like technocratic. And you're just like, I should have done history. Right. And you're a speechwriter at the Pentagon. And you have a day job, right? Where you work in, you're in corporate life. And so I think it's interesting that we were saying, so T.S. Eliot had a day job too, and was pretty prolific. So the other thing is encouraging to all of us that we can make time to write and work hard to get it done. But let's talk about your writing. Like,
sure.
I mean, you go from being a Pentagon speechwriter, so you're already a writer, but a Pentagon speechwriter and communications guy with a technocratic degree, and now you're writing a novel. Talk about a little bit how that happened, and maybe also talk about your writing process and some of the things you learned, and maybe some advice you'd give to others.
Thanks. I think it's really important if you're out there and you want to write, and you know you're a parent, and your time is not your own. You know, 16 hours a day, you're taking care of little kids, or you've got a job that demands a lot of you, either physically, you know, on the shift, you know, you're doing shift work, or emotionally or mentally, and you come home and you're drained, you know, oh, dear God, it's 6 o'clock and I can fall asleep right now, but I've got to make dinner, wash the dishes, you know, put the kids down, maybe watch some TV with my spouse. It's hard. And I think you can still do it. So in full disclosure, I was able to write most of this while I was in graduate school. And we mentioned the Kirk Center, super grateful to have spent a summer there. That's where I would say I wrote about half of it. The other half I wrote over, you know, I was working in the Senate and, you know, had other jobs and was writing on in other slots of time. And the biggest thing that I think stands out is a very good friend of mine who's now actually at your alma mater. He's teaching at Notre Dame. I asked him about this when I was in graduate school. I said, how do you do it? Because he was traveling everywhere and he was writing a lot. And he said, you have to get rid of the idea that in order to write, you need a quiet room and your cup of coffee and no distractions. He said, just kill that off. He said, if your laptop has battery life, you can be working, you can be writing. And he said, so you can be writing on the bus, on the airport terminal as you're, you know, on a layover waiting to get on the plane. He said, if you have a quiet room and some coffee, that's great. He said, but really, once you just push through the noise, you realize you can actually do work anywhere. And I think for most of us now in the modern life, you know, we've got the phones, we have distractions, we have work. You can do it just about anywhere. But with that being said, I would recommend picking a time of day every day and doing it then and just setting, you know, a timer or an amount of time and clearing the deck. So for me, my best time to write is early in the morning. And so, you know, if I can get up at, you know, 4:15 in the morning, you got to beat the kids. It's hard. You got to get out, you get your day started before the kids get up. So you got to beat them to the finish line or the starting line of the day. But just getting those, you know, even just an hour and a half or 2 hours of quiet time in the morning, you get up and just write and let it come out. It can be garbage, it can be disastrous, but it just has to be out. And then the next day you come back and you're working with garbage, but you've refined it a little bit and you've burnt off most of the garbage. Now it's 20% good, you know? And so I think kind of those two thoughts of you can write anywhere and setting a set time every day. I mean, Louis L'Amour was a prize fighter. He was on a tramp steamer. I mean, he was in the war. He was all over the place. And so he was writing while he would go. Eric Hoffer, you know, the longshoreman philosopher who was writing in the 50s and 60s, and I think the 70s, fascinating figure in the docks in San Francisco. He was a longshoreman, but he was on break, you know, writing and would always just, you know, stuffing pages and notebooks and papers and all of his clothing, just, and then whipping out a pen and just, you know, writing when he had a moment or a thought. You know, we have phones and you can take notes. So it's a messy mismatch of a process, but But that's kind of how I've thought about it, you know, on the go, but also.
No, I think that's good. I mean, that's pretty good and pretty standard. Is it Somerset Maugham or somebody, maybe it's Trollope. I think it's Somerset Maugham. Somebody says like, what do you write when you're inspired or do you write at a certain time? He said, oh, I only write when I'm inspired, but luckily I'm inspired every day at 9 o'clock in the morning.
So that's witty.
Clever. But so you could be tempted to write essays about some of these themes. And by the way, I would just say, for listeners and to you, Bill, there are themes that make your book interesting and good, but it's really just a story about these boys. And then the themes are kind of underlined. They're not, you're not doing social commentary in the theme. There's like a situation, which I'll set out now and then we'll talk about, where there's a man in the town who wants to set up a reservoir. And that reservoir is going to mean they're going to flood this whole area, this valley, where Pete and Will and Jack and Frank, well, and the parents and then Frankie, they all live in this old stone house. And there's a couple neighbors that are going to be hurt as well. But the guy who's in charge or who has the idea is very involved in the city. He's got lots of influence, lots of connections, and he's basically got the city council in his pocket. And not necessarily fully corrupt, but he's got them in their pocket, right? Like they're going to, and you know, there's a little backstory that he may be able to use this land that he has to kind of make some money on a Lakeview and things like that. So that, and I'm giving a little of the story away, but there's this tension there. And so they're like, well, what are we going to do? Well, they have to join together. And then they find there's this very wealthy character that Jack's father has done some work for. And all of a sudden he pulls up in the stone house and little Jack is like, oh my goodness, you know, it's like the richest person in the town is here at our house. I mean, it's again, interesting because he's a little boy, you know, that guy's worth millions of dollars and he's at our house. And it turns out he's at our house because he just thinks it's unjust. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, all right, I can't solve your problem, but I can help you a little bit. And they get together and they build the community and they try to fight this and you kind of work that out and I won't give away what happens, but and so I think there's these themes, but it's not like, it's, you know, I would say, you know, as Alexis de Tocqueville reminds us, individualism leads to centralization and therefore we need decentralization. I mean, I would write a boring essay about that. And you wrote a nice book about it.
Oh, thank you.
So tell me just a little bit. I mean, you're a speechwriter and you were a licensed technocrat with that degree from University of Pennsylvania. Right. and yet you said, I'm going to do a novel. So maybe like, well, how about I'll ask it this way. Let's say I have some ideas. I want to write a novel instead of, I want to explain this in a story.
Sure.
Like, how did you do it? What did you do? How did you discipline yourself to make sure you didn't go into essay writing and what about the tension, et cetera?
Thanks. That's a great question. And I think you've nailed it. The first and most important thing is just tell an entertaining story. And think about, you know, everyone has a great story to tell. I believe everyone's got at least one book in them. Hopefully more, but everyone's got at least one. And I think you're right. Don't worry about themes. Don't worry about, you know, sending a message or you know.
Well, do you worry about themes? I get the message part's clear. Like, don't send a message. Just but like, is there a theme? I mean, did you? You seem to have a theme, like I want to talk about family and hope.
Right. I think in general, so sure, in general, yes, I had the theme of family and, you know, kind of human dignity. But, and I think this bears out, you can actually almost forget about that while you're telling the story. And if you're making the story really interesting and engaging and put all of your conscious effort into that, the themes will subconsciously present themselves. I think they'll come up and they'll be part of it. And that'll be a reflection of your experience, you know, your life, your reading, your education. That will all kind of present itself there. And then in writing that first draft of telling first and foremost an interesting story or a fun and entertaining story, you'll see the themes there. And then on rewrites or edits, you can add a little oomph to them or submerge them as you see fit. But I do think that it should be organic. And the best stories will kind of naturally do that. And it'll happen in ways that maybe you're not even really aware of. But so, for example, my agent, who was a Vietnam veteran and had served in Vietnam, you know, he was talking to me about the book and why he liked it. And he talked about the war, the Vietnam War, he said, as a character in the book. And he said, well, the war is definitely a character in the book. Mm-hmm. And I would never even have thought of that. I didn't set out to make that happen. But he said, no, he says it appears at certain times and it drives changes in the story. And it shows up almost like a creature, like a monster. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the fore and it forces people to do things and then it recedes again. Then it comes back. And in retrospect, I think that's very true, but it isn't something.
I would agree. It's a character. Now, I mean, I wouldn't maybe have thought that way either, yeah. The war is clearly a character.
But it's not something I set out, oh, I'm going to make the Vietnam War kind of a character that does these things. I thought about it a lot, of course, while I was writing it, but to look at it that way wasn't something I consciously tried to do.
This is a two-part question. Some of this comes from just your experience growing up and the experience of your family, your uncle, aunts and uncles. And so that experience part, and then how much of, like, you decide, I'm going to do some history research and kind of combine the things together. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So my aunts and uncles and my mother grew up on this beautiful, you know, piece of land and, you know, had their adventures there. It was a rural environment. And then a generation later, you know, my siblings and cousins and I grew up and had our own adventures kind of over top, some of which had kind of intersection with the previous generation's adventures and stories. So, for example, one of those was this airplane wreck. There was actually an airplane that crashed and came down in the 50s during the Cold War. And in the book, you know, these boys at one point want to go find this airplane wreck. It's kind of a MacGuffin for them, but they want to go find it. Well, and my uncles used to go out and find pieces of this old airplane wreck. And then when we were in junior high, grade school, we heard about it. And we decided, well, we're going to go find those pieces. There are probably still pieces scattered out on that forested hillside in Pennsylvania. And we did. And I still have some of those pieces. We you know, got together and we walked out there and we endured trials on our way to find these airplane pieces. At one point, we trotted through a wasp's nest. It was a rotten log filled with wasps. And we stepped on it and we just were beset by wasps. And we dropped all of these fantastic airplane pieces we found and just took off running. I think we were like 10 years old or whatever. So, you know, those sorts of things, of course, influenced the story. But also the oral tradition of storytelling that I remember and associate very closely with my grandfather, who was a storyteller and, you know, smoked a cigar and sit out on the porch and just listen to granddad tell stories, you know, on those, you know, long blue summer evenings in that part of you know, Pennsylvania and Delaware area. And it was an atmosphere that I loved and wanted to share. And I think at the time, I of course knew that it was a unique way to grow up, just because I was otherwise a very suburban kid and all of my friends in school, you know, pretty much from suburbia. So I knew it was different, but looking back on it now, it was very different, and I was very grateful for that. I think I wanted to share some of that with, one of my best friends talked about growing up in the city and in LA, but loving the book because it wasn't an experience he had as a child. He didn't spend a lot of time outside or kind of, you know, mm-hmm. creeks and snapping turtles and campfires and, you know, that sort of a thing. So I just wanted to share that because it was wonderful.
Yeah. And I think you did a good job evoking that, being outside, and there's something, and I think even that the name, the Last Summer Boys, in one sense, I don't think this is completely true. I mean, we live out in the country and we have some opportunities for that, but, and I grew up in California too. We were outside a lot, but in one sense, some of that's lost for lots of people kind of going out and having adventures and doing things. I think the Last Summer Boys, it was the last summer before things change for that family. Mm-hmm. It's the last summer of Jack's childhood, really, as it were. Now he's going to be, you know, a little bit of an older teenager, and some of the simplicity of life and the naivete is going to, both just the way it is, it goes away, but there's some sadness to it. Like, you've lost some of the mystery, Mm-hmm. I think you evoke that. I think the 68, I mean, is an interesting period, not just because of the political assassinations, but because that's the summer of the cultural social revolutions,
right.
Some of which we're dealing with today that are really quite bad, actually. Well, I mean, I joke. So I have a colleague of mine. We were both born in 1969. And I said, like, we were born to take revenge on 68. So I know the 68 is like a terrible, terrible thing. I mean, I'm quite serious. The 68 revolutions, the sexual revolutions, the student cultural revolutions were very destructive on society, but also created a lot of injustice toward the weak and the vulnerable. And we're seeing that play out today mm-hmm. with incredible amounts of injustice towards the weak and the vulnerable that come out of this kind of 60s revolution, the sexual revolution. Carlo Lancelotti, who's a translator of the Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce, we talk about this on another podcast episode, that the sexual revolution, Del Noce argues, is really an extension of the Marxist revolution. And mm-hmm. this idea of like liberation mm-hmm. and sexual liberation has created family breakdown that's very severe, very difficult, and really hurts women and children. And so that other sense that you have tense there. And again, you can tell me, you know, Michael, like, I'm not doing that at all. I'm just saying, I think that the 1968, the last summer, but the point of the family, Jack knows he's loved, that the mother and father are together. I mean, that still exists today. And yeah. I'm blessed to have a good family, but a lot of people, I did a podcast with Mary Eberstadt on her book, Primal Screams. Mm-hmm. And one of her arguments is that the source of identity politics, the source of anxiety, et cetera, is the primal scream of no longer having a family, no longer having roots and a place. Yeah. Yeah. And in a sense, you know, yours is a novel. And again, I'm doing this to you. So you can say, you can disagree with me, but in a sense, The Last Summer Boys is before the primal screams of loneliness. And I think that's another reason why it's an interesting book. And again, it's not preachy. It's just giving you a vision so that your friend from Los Angeles can say, "Oh, that was great. I got, you know, kind of my imagination awakened." I mean, how do you react to what I've said? You know, feel free to disagree. Of
course. No, I it just rings so true. All of us had a last time we ran outside to play as little children, and we didn't really know it at the time, right? There was, you know, at some point somewhere in our lives, it was probably a summer day. You ran outside to play outside with your friends, and it was the last time you did it with the intent to do that. And you didn't even know it was happening. So that's kind of part of it. 1968, those storms, you know, storm surges through time that we are absolutely wrestling with now. And I think your point about family, it should be your safe harbor and your secure base. So it should be the place from which you can feel safe and loved and protected, but also a place where you feel, you know, confident in jumping out and exploring the world. So many people don't have that today. Again, this, I was speaking with someone and I asked them what problems are solved by really good stories, do you think? What's the most important problem that a really good story solves? And this friend of mine answered, children with unhappy childhoods. He said, because children with unhappy childhoods become adults with whatever that entails. And a beautiful story that is a true story, which means it doesn't mean it's just all happiness and, you know, rainbows and butterflies and there's no pain. Mm-hmm. No, there's real challenge, there's real pain, but a beautiful story will engage with the truth and show you that there is a way to love through pain. You can redeem suffering. Beauty is real. You can find it. We all have a purpose in life. What makes us happiest is actually finding that purpose and living it out in an authentic way, not just indulging whatever whim we have in the moment. And so a good story encountered at any time in life can help us see that. And I don't want to say that, oh, my story is going to cure people's pain who had an unhappy child. No, it's not, can't do that. But it can help, as I think any good story can help, and show you that I was blessed to have a beautiful childhood. You know, it sounds like you were too. Not everyone has that. And there's all these big, broad social forces going on. but in a very focused way. If you, we have our sphere of concern and our sphere of influence, but if you focus down, like, how can I make my family better? How can I better love my spouse today? And sometimes as simple as that. Yeah. Okay. Yesterday we had a big argument. Okay. Well, today, this morning, I am going to run the dishes and I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm just going to do it. And that's going to be my, you know, or with children, you know, the kids were a mess yesterday. Well, today is a reset. And I know for me, you know, you look at, out across the world, there's no shortage of things to be really upset about today. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't engage at the broader cultural level. You should. But start first with, you know, as Voltaire would say, tend your own garden. And the little platoon, right, of the family is make that as strong as you can, and make that a place of a secure, you know, a safe harbor and a secure base. And so I think in the story, I just, rather than kind of say all that, here's all these problems we have, here's, you know, how you can, you know, soothe some of that pain. I just wanted to show it in a story, you know, and you have these brothers. And like you said, there's tension there. The father is supporting Nixon in 1968, and the son, Will, is supporting Bobby Kennedy. And you know, there's this tension, but it's not like they can't coexist under the same roof, and they live together.
Well, and you do this like nicely. I mean, it's interesting to see how you kind of address this problem, because in many ways, you know, the tensions between like Kennedy, Nixon are what I guess you could say Mary Douglas would call a condensed symbols of how to see the world.
And tips of bigger icebergs, right?
Yeah. And so, and, you know, I don't like Kennedy's, not that I like Nixon, so I would have been in a difficult spot. So there's a certain kind of, Will has this young passion, excitement for Bobby Kennedy. And part of that's a desire for justice because of racial injustice. Mm-hmm. And then of course worries about the war, which we talked about as a character. And there's a little bit of a kind of a utopian element to it. And this is the '60s, a 68. I mean, again, I'm using Carlo Ancelotti and specifically the work of the Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce, this point, like we're going to usher in a new time of peace, happiness, joy, where everything kind of fulfills. So it's this immunization of the eschaton that Voegelin talks about. And what happened, as Del Noce explained, is all the hippies just became yuppies and the materialism stayed. And instead of having this like ushering in of a new time, what you have instead is happiness can be purchased through material goods. We shift from Christian bourgeois to pure bourgeois. Everything's transactioned. Mm-hmm. The family breaks apart. You know, there's all these kind of struggles. And like in that, here's Will. Here's Will.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting scene. So Will is feeling a little frustrated because the girl he likes is on a date with somebody else.
Right.
And the guy's a bit of a jerk, to say the least. And he ends up like hurting Frankie. And Will gets in a knockdown, drag out fight. Right. And just is like wailing on this guy. And finally, Jack's like, you finally, you know, saved our honor. Right. Jack is clever. And I get Jack's character here where you explain, like, he's seeing it from his perspective. And and he says, Will is still swearing, but oh my, it's lovely. Such awful cussing you never heard. Right. It's like Jack is just kind of like, he's a kid. He's like, my big brother's fighting and swearing. Like, oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah,
he's back. All this stuff
happens. But it's an honorable thing. He's actually defending the innocent, right? Will is defending the innocent and the weak.
And this is a kind of a subtle thing, but you talked earlier about the character Frankie, who comes into the story as the city boy. We think he's kind of a weak character. Frankie has precipitated that fight on purpose because Frankie is the most emotionally intelligent of all of the characters.
By far.
Perceives the situation, knows that Will is totally deflated because his, you know, hero is gone and the girl he loves is going out with this jerk. And so this jerk is taunting him because he wants to fight him, and Will doesn't have any fight to give because he's defeated. And this is horrifying to this little boy, Jack, because, you know, the bully is, you know, disparaging their family and his brother's not doing anything about it. And so Frankie sees that this situation is not going to be good for anybody if it just is allowed to continue. So he inserts himself and precipitates a fight kind of on a gambit that, okay, Will is too upset to fight this bully on his own behalf, but he might do it on my behalf. And there might be kind of a primal triggering of his sense of justice. If I insert, because Frankie's a little boy, he's really, you know, he's physically small. And this bully is a
skinny fellow.
He's skinny. He's not physically intimidating. And he basically, you know, goads this bully into swatting him, smacking him. And that flicks the switch and Will engages. Right. And it's, I guess it is kind of complicated, but Frankie somehow intuits all of this and decides now is the time to act. And I can't fight this big bully with physical strength, but I can fight him with words and I can trigger a change in Will. And that's Will's turning point.
There's a couple things that come from that, which are really interesting that I was going to bring up. So I'm glad you brought that up. There's a couple of nice scenes that you deal with. So Frankie, as you said, he's kind of skinny. He's a little bit weak, but he's tough. And you said he's emotionally intelligent and he sees what's happening. And so he literally takes a hit for the team.
Yes.
He knows, all right, if I'm going to get the tar beaten out of me, but it's going to be okay. I'm going to sacrifice my physical comfort for this. So he insults the boy, gets him to work up, and he's bleeding, right? And that, of course, this is the boy who's on the date with the Anna May that Will likes.
Yeah, the bully, yeah.
And Anna May is a good person. And she's disgusted that this Everett bully would hit this boy. I mean, like, that's the end, right? She's disgusted.
Frankie has shown her who the boy is.
Right. Now you know that this guy's a total loser.
Right.
Okay. And she's like, she already intuits it a little bit,
she
but
does.
She's like, but now it's clear. Okay. He's a total loser. And so she says, lie still. Are you move? And he's like, because Will, he's like, my brother hits him like a torpedo. This is what Jack describes, right? Like, all of a sudden Will's like, that's it. And just starts wailing this guy. And Frankie's like, she's like, lie down. And Frankie says, is he still fighting? And I say, can't you hear him? And you hear Will is just like rolling, you know, getting him. And Frankie, he's like, the girl says, you've cut your lip. He says, I'm fine, says Frankie. I want to see it. Right. And so you could tell at the point he says, Frankie, finally, Will beats the guy up. Right. Comes to Frankie. He's like, are you okay? It's peachy. Right, like he knows I did that. Like and he doesn't really let Will completely know, but you can see this, and then this reconciles him to himself. Will, sorry, the middle boy to himself.
Yes,
to Anna May, mm-hmm. to Jack and right. Frankie.
Yeah,
and then he goes back to his parents, and now a great scene that I like. This scene, it's midnight in the kitchen. Frankie's got ice all over him, right? Pete, the older boy, and the younger boy are watching Will. And dad has had some whiskey and he gives Frankie a little whiskey to heal him. Pete's like, can I have whiskey? He's like, be quiet.
Yeah, right.
Like he's not, and dad, like the dad is not happy right now. And he says, he looks at Will with icy eyes. You're right. But he ain't spoke yet. That means there's still hope for him. So anyway, finally they all get sent away and Will gets it from his father. You don't know. Nobody knows. Cause the narrator, the first person's not there. And finally, it's hours before I hear Will come up the steep stairs. By then, Pete and Frank are asleep. Did you get in trouble, Will? I whisper. Not exactly, he answers. Well, that's good. I wait. Dad wants me to talk more, Will says. About what? About anything I feel like. He says he'll listen. That's beautiful. And it goes on further, but it's beautiful because what you see here is amidst the tension of Bobby Kennedy's assassination, the war, the tension of the Cultural Revolution, Will needs a father who will listen. And the father needs to, in a sense, humble, like we all do, to say, okay, you can talk. Because, you know, I mean, like, you're a father, I'm a father. Like, you know, I have a 19-year-old. Like, what does he know? Well, actually, he knows a lot. And I have to listen to him to get his perspective. And there's a temptation to, like, just kind of brush it off. But I think, in a sense, what you also show, it's related to that, the point of the book that I like, where Jack knows he's loved, is that Will's loved. Will's affirmed by his mother and his father. And the facts are, like, you have to, and this goes back to your little platoon point of Edmund Burke. Each of us in our, like, that Covey, I like that Covey distinction of, like, the circle of influence, circle of concern. That I think what's inspiring, each of us, it's an inspiring point. Like, for me, I think, you know, I'm a father. I have teenagers and teenagers are growing. They have opinions, they have views, and and they have insights. And part of it, you can't treat them like little children. You have to treat them like adults, right? And appropriately. And they need guidance. But I think what's inspiring is that, and I think very relevant for today, right? That there's cultural revolution right now. It's a reverberation from the 68. There's political problems. There's social problems. There's ideology everywhere. And amidst all the ideology and all the social problems, truth matters, but truth can matter with love in your family. And so I think what the father does is they disagree politically, they disagree socially. And yet he says, well, I want you to talk about it and we can have a discussion, because it's in that dialogical relationship that we're also going to, moderate ideology. We're going to moderate objectification of others and see each other as subjects. And Will, which you bring out, is struggling not just from the loss of his hero, but the girlfriend. He's not sure what to do. He's struggling with the war because he's next in line after Pete, and he doesn't want Pete to leave, but he's quiet about it. Whereas mm-hmm. Jack is very emotional and open about it. Will's not. He's suppressing it in. And so the father says, you need to talk more.
Yeah.
And so that he can, in a sense, Will can begin to process articulately what's happening, and then that relationship goes. And I think that's a beautiful element of the book, and I think, and also affirmation of family, but also affirmation of proper use of authority. And it's very good. I liked it a lot.
Thank you so much for that. Going back to the point about themes, it's something that when I wrote it, I'm just, you're just trying to get through this scene without losing any sense of the realism of it. And of course you want it to push the story forward or drive the story forward. And so you're writing, and then you go back later and read it and think, oh, look what's happening there, and I affirm everything you just said about that. I just, in the moment of writing, it's not necessarily what you're thinking. I'll give another example, Will and his father.
Before you give the example, do you think, the talk more is great. It's a great, what was the inspiration of that? It's just super. It was, well, I went on a big, long description of some of the things I got from it. And there's more that I could have said even, but it's just a short, it's talk more. What was the inspiration?
My father was and is a great listener. Would listen to me and my siblings. And so that's just kind of part of it. But I also thought that this character of the dad here, I think there was some sense that, okay, my son has a lot of anger that just exploded out in this fight that was ultimately a good thing, right? Because it did reconcile everyone. Yep. And
was still a lot of anger.
But there was a lot of anger. And I think my general sense there is that this father recognizing there's a lot of raw energy here that needs to be channeled. And in this particular instance, in that scene you're writing with the father, their father wants to know why the fight went down. And when he finds out that it was partly a matter of a family honor, he kind of relaxes a little bit about it because, he affirms that. He believes in that. But I think the father's big concern is, I think he wanted to make sure that Will didn't just fight the guy because he was angry that he was dating his girl, and he wanted to make sure that he wanted to make sure Will was not acting unjustly. Then he finds out this bully hits their little cousin and that Will is fighting him for that. All of his concern kind of goes away about the fight itself. And the father himself interiorly, I think, relaxes, at least in my mind. The dad relaxes when he understands the situation as to how it was. But he still has a 16-year-old son who is capable of taking apart this much, much bigger bully in a really violent way. And so that energy needs to be channeled. And I think, for young men and young boys, that's a reality of high school boys. They have that energy, and
there's anger. You have to.
There's anger, and part of that
articulate.
This is, I think,
challenge for men generally, but especially for teenage boys. Mm-hmm. Even talkative writing people like you and I, sometimes sadness or anger, frustration, it's inarticulate. So it just manifests itself in some type of anger as opposed to walking through it. And so I think there's also that philosophical element, you have to pause and reflect, and to talk more is
is a way.
Especially for teenage boys who aren't very good at talking.
Yeah.
But also this boy who's specifically political and energetic, and I think probably feels, because he and his father and mother disagree, like he can't say what he really thinks. And the father's like, say what you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just letting that come out, and that there's value in itself. Just talking something out, lets the steam out a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not going to change how the son necessarily feels about the war or Bobby Kennedy, but it is going to help him, like you say, process the emotion and the anger and the energy that he has as a 16-year-old boy.
And hopefully he'll grow up and he won't like the Kennedy.
And hopefully, okay, yeah, and hopefully he passes through that, you know? or he learns how to channel it well. This is kind of a much more later application of it, but if you've ever seen any of the Marvel movies, the Avengers, in mm-hmm. the first Avengers, my favorite scene is at the end when, you know, Dr. Banner comes back, Dr. Banner, and, you know, the Hulk, and I think Captain America, you know, the bad guys are tearing apart New York City, and Captain America says, hey, now would be a good time for you to get angry, to Hulk out and become, you know, the warrior that we need to fight these bad guys. And he tells him, that's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry. That character at the end of that movie, it can almost turn on the warrior mentality, you know, become the Hulk and fight the bad guys when he needs to do that. And I think Will later in life, hopefully, is probably always has a little bit of that anger. Some people do.
But it's for justice and order.
For not, justice and not order. For,
yeah.
Knowing
Joseph
when
Pieper's very good on that. The philosopher,
yes.
Joseph Pieper.
Yeah.
If you read him.
I have. Not recently, but and that's a righteous anger, right? You know, an anger for justice.
It's dangerous. Like, anger is very dangerous. I mean, this is a different, because, you know, St. Francis de Sales says, never get angry.
My favorite saint. Yeah.
You like him. I do too. Yeah. I like him. St. John Cassian mm-hmm. puts anger in one of the vices. Mm-hmm. The rule of St. Benedict, don't give free reign to your anger, you know, reign mm-hmm. to your anger. So, and then Pieper in the Thomistic tradition kind of articulates the tradition of Thomas, saying anger is given to us not as it's not an evil. It's for the purpose of fighting injustice and fighting against our sins. Mm-hmm. But as all the spiritual doctors warn, be very, very careful.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, another element of that tension, that you have to be careful with anger. You know, and then if you see this in the Hulk, right? There's a lot of people who are destroyed because he can't control his anger, right? So mm-hmm. back to the Marvel thing. But this anger issue, I've never thought I would compare the Hulk and Joseph Pieper, but... anyway, you were going to say, though, Bill, I took you down this pathway on the talk more. I don't know if you remember, but you were going to say give another example.
Oh, yeah. Something that I realized later, you know, Will and his father have these fights earlier on, these big political arguments, and Will kind of storms out of the house and goes across the fields to kind of walk it off and be angry. But his father goes and sits and waits on the porch. And waits for him to come mm-hmm. back. And I just kind of wrote that because I felt like that's what, you know, this character of a good father would do. And then I went back and read later and I thought, oh, it's a little bit of the prodigal son.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when the prodigal son comes back, the father sees him, you know, the phrase, you know, while he was still a long way off, implying right. that his dad was coming waiting. Out and waiting for him to come back at that time.
So that's very good, Bill. Let's move now to this question that I brought up a little bit earlier. This Tocquevillian theme, you deal with the issue of community. And so there's a situation with a family where the local community, or at least some leaders in the local community, want to build a dam, to build a reservoir that would basically flood the area where the old stone house is of the family. And the community comes together to try to solve this problem. And I think you bring out a couple of interesting points. One, the importance of community. Two, the tension between economic growth, which can be very good, but also can create problems, create tensions, winners and losers. And then I think, and maybe we talked about this a little bit, this nobility of one of the wealthiest members in the community to help out, to have a certain noblesse oblige. Maybe could you talk about this and why did you decide to include that, in a sense, tension between eminent domain, economic growth, the value of community, and these kind of Tocquevillian themes?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much there, but the shortest way to say it is that I didn't think you could set a story in 1968 in post-war America and not at least touch on that, the post-war growth and the, you know, in small towns, you know, the rise of suburbia and kind of the tension between city folk, town folk, and those who were more rural. That almost by design had to be something that was talked about. But just because there is a difference doesn't mean there needs to be tension. And I think what I wanted to say with, you know, in the story is that the family is the primary unit. They love each other and they fight for each other. And then once they stabilize themselves, their family unit, they engage with other families, groups of other families, both in the rural countryside and also in the town. And that's what community is. Family is kind of the atomic unit, and groups of families are the next level. And that's community. And there is a tension between a greedy corporate, you know, or a government, you know, shady bureaucrat who seems to be aligned with some corporate interests, and it's not very clear, but he's a villain, and he has a lot of concentrated power. He has the town council that he controls, and in order to oppose him, you know, the family by themselves are not enough. They can't marshal enough resources to do that. But with other families, they can, and with the church, they can. And they do a lot of coalition building, and I won't give anything away, but they have to reach out to some unconventional partners. They need to bring in some heavier firepower. But you mentioned the character of kind of this aristocrat who chooses to help them. And he's the one who advises this coalition, the one who, he's not necessarily a super active participant, but he's an advisor. And he chooses to engage, even though he would be unaffected and probably even benefited by the bureaucrat's scheme. But he chooses to engage because he respects the father and he thinks it's unjust. And I think that's the original role, and the role still for people who are blessed with, you know, resources or influence in their community. Their job is to look out for justice in an authentic way. And he does that, and but it starts with relationship. He has a relationship with his family, and he knows the father and he respects the father. And that's why he chooses to, you know, give his time. So, yeah, so that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I think it's all of those things.
That was good. Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, a couple of things. I'm rereading Revolt of the Elites and Betrayal of Democracy by Christopher Lash. And in one sense, there's a revolt of the elites where the crony capitalist bureaucrat with corporate interests and his own interests is operating on one side. And then there's an ability for the other aristocratic elite to, in a sense, have nothing to do with it. But he stands in because he cares for justice. And I think, you know, it's a Tocquevillian themes, but also a Burkean theme of that society is this partnership between the dead, the living, and the yet to be born. And that you're thinking long term over the generations, so that the short term value of this economic growth may be good for the community, but will in fact break apart some of the stable members of this community that help it perpetuate. And to perpetuate order is hard. And I think it's important. I think in, you know, just in our time, we're in, you know, high inflation and all these things going on. But a lot of what we're seeing is an inability for people to think long-term, right? In order to think generationally and intergenerationally. And so I thought that was an interesting part of the book. And of course, like, you wrote it at the Kirk Center, as we talked about, where,
right,
you know,
right.
Where Russell Kirk, of course, a big admirer of Edmund Burke and this whole idea of this responsibility of the elites to perpetuate the order and family and think long term, not simply just to like look after oneself and one's own interests. And I thought that was an interesting, well done story, and not in a preachy manner. I mean, we're talking about it here, you know, kind of looking at it. I think you just tell the story in a very nice way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thanks, Bill, for your time. It's been really, I enjoyed your book.
Thank you,
so thanks for reaching out to me. And I'm so glad I had the chance to read it. I encourage everybody to get the book, Last Summer Boys. It's a pleasant read, a good read. And I think if you've heard us talking, there's a lot of, of content in it. Anything before we finish that you want to share about the book? Any like maybe something that struck you that has always, like, the thing you always talk about, I guess, when you're asked about this book that maybe we didn't discuss want to repeat is fine.
Sure. Well.
And then also tell us maybe where we can find you and learn more about your writing.
Yeah. No, thanks, Michael. Thank you again just for having me. It's just been a delightful conversation. It really has. The book is available on Amazon, of course. I am on Twitter at Rivers Writes and Instagram at Bill.Rivers. So people can connect there. And just, you know, the last thing about the book, and this just happened the other day, I think the book is accessible to everyone. And of course, every author would say that. But my good friend of mine, a neighbor, his little boy, I think, is about 6 years old, and they've been reading the book to him. And he has his favorite character, and he was playing with his buddies, and he was being that character from the story. And I just was bowled over. So
that's so great. Yeah, who is the character?
The character was the oldest brother, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Good. Well, I'll put links to your book and then some reviews of your book and also to your Instagram and Twitter. Bill, thank you very much for joining the Moral Imagination podcast. And I hope you write another novel, and I hope you come back.
Thank you so much.
Okay. All the best.